Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of State of the YouTube. Today, Monkey Jones is not here to interrupt my intro because he is living life high in
New York City.
I have too much respect for you to do it myself, Emperor Lemon.
Is this just going to become a thing on the show where everyone interrupts the intro? What good is a podcast without a lengthy intro where in the future we'll probably put an ad reading to make even more money off of these suckers listening right now? But yeah, Mumkey is off today. He is in New York City with the one and only Asterios Kokonos doing whatever ridiculous debauchery they're up to, being drunk during the day and the night and the following day.
And yeah, what are they doing? Live shows?
Yeah, they're doing
of their
Boomer versus Zoomer, Mumkey's other podcast, which he prioritizes over ours, I guess. Even though we get more views.
I'm interested to see.
Ew.
Well, now there's a conflict between our podcasts.
Well, anyway, instead of Mumkey, we are here with very special guest, 1 million plus subs on YouTube, the internet historian.
Welcome, sir.
How's it going?
We almost had you on once before, but complications meant that we had to cut you out, and that was on the Quentin Reviews interview episode. And it sucked. It sucked that we couldn't get your audio worked out, because you had some really good insight, I guess, just kind of like mediating the interview in ways that I was not able to that night.
Yeah, well, I mean, I didn't say much, but I can't remember. There was just a couple of questions, but it was interesting being a fly on the wall for that conversation. I'm glad you edited out all the scandalous things there. There were some pretty heated debates between M. Fleming there and Quentin. You guys really fought it out, but I'm glad you edited all that stuff out in the final version.
Wait, were there really? I don't remember. I was practically
editing.
Yeah,
remember when you were, you know, and then Quentin said the N-word, and
oh,
he's
yeah,
like, no,
you
got to
right.
take that out.
yeah, that was, you know, maybe unethical as a podcast editor, but he requested that I take out those scandalous things that he said, and so I did that.
Yeah, he said, I'll never come on again. I'll never be another guest if you don't take away all those F and N bombs. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to be on the podcast ever again anyways.
Mm. Oh, why is that?
Well, unless he wants to, but I don't think that he likes any of us very much.
Yeah, no, I don't foresee him coming back anytime soon.
Well, you know, after that episode came out, I started watching your videos, and I subscribed to your channel, and the next video came out instantly made me a fan. I think it was the planking one, like the history of planking.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was one of those things where I would never think to make like a long documentary style, I guess it wasn't that long, but style video about planking and just all the deaths and statistics behind it. But I learned a lot.
Yeah. Oh, thanks, man. Yeah. Don't forget to like and subscribe. Yeah. No, it's funny that video is such a cut down version of what the original was going to be. So I had this plan to do this like compilation video the same way. There's another video called like Any Poll's a Goal, and it's like these three different stories and they kind of mash together with a theme. And so I was going to go through planking and then the cinnamon challenge, which also had a death. And then I was going to go through the fire challenge and just go through all this stuff. And it was going to be like a 15-minute video. And then just so much time had passed between videos and it just wasn't working. It wasn't gelling together. And so I was like, oh, fuck it. And cut the whole thing down to 5 minutes.
I mean, I think that's not a bad idea, just to have a series on its own where you cover each one if there's enough material to be covered.
Yeah, well, that ended up being the main problem. The problem is with the fire challenge one, there's a good chance you're just going to get a community strike. 'Cause,
oh, yeah.
You know, it's just kids setting themselves on fire. But the cinnamon challenge one, there just wasn't enough material without seeming kind of like a PSA channel. being like, sure, hey kids, don't do this because, you know, it'll fuck up your lungs in this way and that way. And here's the
how did the person die? Campaign.
They were asthmatic.
That was fucking stupid of them.
Yeah, well, but it's one of those things, like, you never expect it to be as bad as it is. Because right. everyone thinks, like, oh, like, it, you know, even with a teaspoon, say, you go, well, who couldn't do that? You just put it in your mouth and you wait for saliva to do the trick. But that mm-hmm. that's not actually how it works, because the thing is kind of hydrophobic, and any small movements in your tongue are going to cause, because this powder is so fine, is going to cause it to touch the uvula at the back of your throat. And as soon as it does that, that immediately triggers an involuntary cough reflex. And if you hold that in, then all of that just goes through your airways. And that's if you try to hold it in. So the more you try to hold it in, the worse it gets. And then once you start choking, it's impossible to stop, because so you're sort of coughing. But then you need to take air in again, and then all this powder is coated all over the inside of your mouth. And so every time you try to breathe in, it gets worse. And this can go on for like 2 to 3 minutes. So you think, you know, it's all sort
of
over.
Yeah, if you can't breathe, yeah, then you're fucked. Pretty much holding your breath for 3 minutes.
Yeah, that's when you in the worst possible moment as well, when you really need air. Yeah.
So is this for an upcoming video where you've split off the original plan of combining those three ideas, and it seems like you've researched the cinnamon challenge to an extent. So hopefully that's a preview for what's to come on the Internet Historian channel.
Sorry, that was a bit of a long diatribe, yeah, straight off the bat. Sorry. I'll be a bit more back and forth. That was all just stuff that was cut. I don't think I'll end up doing a video on the cinnamon challenge. There just isn't quite enough.
There's no bigger story there to be found.
Not really. There was this silly girl who started a campaign after she collapsed one of her lungs doing the challenge, and tries to raise money. But other than that,
dude, that pisses
nowhere.
Me off. What she was raising money for herself?
No,
for
against the awareness cause.
The awareness of the cinnamon challenge,
or the awareness of collapsed lungs?
Both. Raising awareness so that people don't do the cinnamon challenge because they'll collapse their lungs.
Okay.
I mean, what kind of campaign do you really need? Awareness campaign do you really need to raise to let people know not to light themselves on fire, or do something that you can clearly see is horribly painful and makes it difficult to breathe?
Well, you got to get that online clout, those retweets, those Instagram likes. It's all worth it.
Yeah. Yeah,
God, it sucks. Sucks too that you can't upload in any of the letting yourself on fire challenge ones. I mean, now that you know, with YouTube's cracking down on people self-immolating.
Rip the knife game.
Yeah, oh, yeah. A lot of the context doesn't matter anymore. Yeah, it's a bit of a shame.
Yeah, well, anyways, a lot of people have been saying.
What was that, by the way? That was negative 80 million views or something.
Yeah, and I tried to private the videos initially because I thought that maybe that was a workaround. No, it was still negative 80 million views, at least as far as Social Blade was
and
concerned.
And you found that out, like, right on the podcast as we were recording Rusty's live reaction to seeing negative 80 million views in his Social Blade.
Have you considered doing something like this where if you've got the videos privated, why not make them all public again? For a day,
yeah,
and then private them again for a day, and then just keep doing that on alternative days for like a week and see what it does to the algorithm.
What I would imagine, so I did think about that, because what I was thinking, it'd look really good if I gained 80 million views in one day. I'm worried that if I'm doing something like that, that might trigger YouTube somehow, and they might kind of be flagged, tipped off to it, and then look into it.
Right.
And at that point, they can just, once the videos are up, they can just start striking them all. But
right.
Yeah, what would that do to the algorithm? Would that, if I'm just gaining all these views,
well,
and then they instantly go away again?
It's interesting food for thought, that's for sure. Well, at least, Rusty, you haven't had the worst view decline this month, because Machinima, at one point the number 4 biggest channel on YouTube, deleted all of their videos. They had over 10,000 videos, I believe, where, for those of you not familiar with the Machinima model, it's this thing on YouTube called an MCN, a multi-channel network, and they were one of the first ones that really allowed monetization for like small YouTubers.
And yeah, I was signed on to them for 2 years.
A lot of the gimmick was that these YouTubers could upload their content to the main Machinima channel, which theoretically had a much bigger audience and would get them more exposure.
Hmm.
But recently, Machinima merged with what used to be Full Screen. Now they got bought out by a bigger company. I don't remember the name currently. But they got bought out, and earlier this month, they just literally deleted all of their videos at one time. And on Social Blade, they got a minus 1.5 billion views for one day.
My God. Why did they do this?
I don't know. I'm
guessing... Wait, sorry. Did you just say because it's because they got bought out?
Yeah, they got bought out by a bigger MCN, because MCNs are kind of failing. They're kind of part of a bygone era. And a lot of them just don't... They're just not as good as regular YouTube partnerships. So, and they have a lot of bad PR from YouTubers who've shared like horror stories with just getting screwed over by their MCN. So they're just struggling to sign new people.
And oh, yeah, it's like
a lot of them are just going
scheme.
Out of business. And it's all converging into like these one super conglomerate.
So what's left of value if not the brand?
For Machinima?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think there's ever been anything like this happen in the history of YouTube, where a big, giant channel just deletes all of their videos, which are still earning revenue and getting views. And I'm sure when you have that many videos on your channel, a bunch of them are probably still getting some views in the algorithm, then, and they just up and deleted all of them. So it's kind of confusing, which it leads me to believe it might be a contractual thing with the agreements or whatever of the buyout, where they could no longer...
Well, they
kind of
did something
videos.
Like that with Vevo channels, because YouTube was starting their YouTube Music platform. It's on the same platform, but I guess they're just trying to overtake Apple Music and things like Vevo. So what they were doing is collecting all of your music channels on all these different all of your videos on all these different channels. So say if I had a Vevo, not only would I have my music that I upload on my channel, but also whatever songs I sold or licensed out to Vevo, and then YouTube would take all those and put them together in one channel. So that seemed to make more sense, but they must have had a deal with Vevo as opposed to Machinima. Whatever they're doing is outside of YouTube, so they don't have the same option to just move all their videos and views over to this new channel.
That's true.
Well, is that the plan? Is it, I mean, I can sort of see it going two different ways. It's like maybe they're under contractual obligation to delete all these videos, or maybe they're taking them down so that they can be re-uploaded somewhere else, and it's more of a sort of best of case. And then,
yeah, but God, these videos have to be so fucking old at this point. I mean, Machinima is since the beginning of YouTube, so it's like some of these videos are 10 years old, gameplay videos.
I mean, probably like 99% of these are getting less than 5 views a week, because they just have so many in that back catalog, and a lot of them are from just kind of no-name people that have long since left YouTube, so there's not really any reason for anyone to be searching for them at all.
Well, you repackage them up and you sell them as Machinima Classic.
Aha.
Yeah.
Who would buy
new
that?
New streaming platform, $9.99 a month.
When are we going to start doing that, go to a subscription service?
Well, it's already moving in that direction, isn't it, with memberships?
Yeah, but I wonder if it'll ever reach that point where you have to do it to survive on YouTube, or if there'll be like a rift between the subscription channels and the free channels, or will the free channels all just be complete garbage at that point?
I don't know. I think you have a hard time in this day and age competing with anything that gives away something for free. It's just that this generation of mostly people my age and younger, we have become used to just getting every media thing for free. And if it's not free, it's going to have just a significant barrier of entry for just new customers.
Yeah, now, you say your age. Internet historian, you're a very old man.
That's right.
Yeah. I'm guessing just by the way you talk. Okay. So you've been around since the beginning of time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, since the primordial stew and all that stuff.
Okay, well, here's one thing I wanted to ask. Old Harold. Uh-huh. Old internet historian.
Uh-huh.
So, a lot of people don't realize this, but your YouTube channel is actually very new. I believe you started in 2017, is that correct?
Yeah, January 1st.
Oh, cool. Wow. So, well, one thing a lot of people will praise your channel for is that you cut out pretty much all the fat. You don't really have any nothing uploads that kind of just waste people's time. All of your uploads are just like rich in content and really tightly written and heavily edited.
Oh, and yeah, they're very well edited.
It's sort of like the Vsauce style of content creation where you don't upload very often, but when you do, it's sort of like a must-see thing. I guess where I was going with this is this your first YouTube channel? Because it seems like just from your very first videos, they're all like quite good, and it makes me believe that possibly you had some experience before on YouTube.
Oh, no. It was, first YouTube channel and sort of made on a whim. I don't know.
What made you want to start in the first place?
I remember it was, I was looking up Battletoads originally and thought, I remember that. That was quite funny. And I was looking up clips and stuff, and I was just so surprised to see that no one had taken all those clips and put them together into like a coherent narrative. And once I sort of realized that, I just, maybe I should do it. And then I tried to make a video. And then that was quite difficult in the beginning because I'd never used like a video editing software before. I'd used Photoshop before because I'd done some graphic design things. But, I just had to sort of Google everything and hope for the best.
That's impressive because your videos are heavily edited with graphics and that are motion graphics and whatnot. That me being somewhat, I guess, experienced editing, I'm looking at it and I see a lot of work. But
right.
I don't know. Are these easy to do, or they take fucking forever to, you know, have the hands on a steering wheel? And I'm trying to remember what I saw in the planking video mainly. No, it was in the other video.
Yeah, in the planking one, there is, yeah, hands on a steering wheel. Yeah, there's a guy planking on top of a car, and he's, his destination is a coma. It just takes a long time, I suppose. It's not terribly complicated. It's all just like rotation and motion set to sort of keyframes.
Shitload of layers, shitload of keyframes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is difficult, though. I mean, it's like, sure, the individual steps are easy, but you can say that about anything. It's just piecing it all together and having the mind to make it this complex rather than just getting lazy and only showing a stagnant image while you speak over it. That really adds quality to your videos.
Right. Yeah, thanks, man. Yeah, well, it's kind of a double-edged sword, because I suppose I sort of look at these things and, you know, by the time I finish editing a video, I must have looked at it 400 times from start to finish. So it's really hard to sort of judge your own stuff. So it does help to have, like, historian there, and I'll turn to her and I go, is this funny? Is this funny? And she'll go, no. And I go, oh, okay, well, I'll cut that bit out. But I just do that tons and tons over the process. But the problem is, you also look at things way too much and you forget what other people don't know. So I think there are a couple and I think there are a couple of much weaker videos on the channel as well because of it. Like the Asif and Mordecai video, the season 6 He Will Not Divide Us video, the Leroy Jenkins video. It's like those are all a product of like looking at a thing for too long and doing it again and again and again and again, and like it just sort of not.
Yeah, because you're filling in the blanks in your head, and you know how the story's going, and then you forget how much do I need to break this video down or this narrative down to clarify it to the audience?
Yeah,
or are they gonna be able to piece in the missing pieces that I didn't necessarily explain? Like you got to figure out how dumb you expect your audience to be, and I mean dumb like ignorant to what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, and it all sticks in your working memory as well, and that's impossible to get rid of. Like, you know, I used to work as a copywriter, and so you're doing a lot of proofreading, and you just can't keep reading the same thing over and over again without taking a break in between, because all of the mistakes sort of get sort of locked into your working memory, and you actually read things that aren't there.
Yeah, so right, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, that's actually one of the things I think is a very big positive about your videos, where it requires a pretty high degree of context to fully understand everything that's going on, especially with a lot of your older stuff with 4chan. You kind of have to be aware of the culture of 4chan a little bit to kind of get a lot of the stuff. But I think that's a big positive with your stuff because I just really don't like when I'm watching a YouTube video that's supposed to be informative. And just to give you an example, I was watching one on Pokemon the other day, and the guy just spends the first 2 minutes explaining what Pokemon is. Like, everyone on the internet knows what Pokemon is, but it's like a spectrum. You have to kind of judge on what information is correct to leave out and what can you just assume your audience knows. But also, I feel like, and I have to think about this a lot when I'm researching my own videos and writing them. We're on the internet, and I make videos for YouTube, and YouTube is on the internet. There's a big old search bar on YouTube, and probably one for Google, depending on what browser you're using. And people can just look up, they can pause the video and just look up whatever they want that they're confused
it's
about.
It's right there.
I mean, you don't want people clicking off of your video, but yeah, if you're actually interested in the thing, just figure it out real quick. But obviously nobody in the comments section ever does, because they have to ask every question possible to clarify something that was either already stated or very easy to find the answer to themselves.
I've never really lost out by not assuming that people can figure out the context for themselves. I think it's almost the opposite of television, where television, or you know, there's this stupid adage that's like, well, you never go wrong by betting on the idiocy of the American people or whatever, however it goes. But I think it's almost the opposite for the internet. It's like you're supposed to sort of give people the benefit of the doubt that they understand a lot of these things. And
right, and that's why they clicked on the video in the first place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a big thing. Everything on YouTube is completely on demand. On TV, stuff is just you're watching a channel and it comes on, and you have to explain how many football fields this big thing is. But on YouTube, you can pretty much take it for granted. Like, oh yeah, a blimp. It's pretty big. I don't know, just an example, but whatever. You don't have to explain what Pokemon is to me.
Yeah, and then the audience also doesn't feel pandered to. And they're more on your side. Yeah.
Yeah, well, even in your the video that you made about the lady that was fired from Applebee's.
Yeah,
was it? So there's the whole campaign to get her rehired. I had never heard of that before. So I was watching your video. I was fucking confused. But it didn't take long before I could piece it together and figure out what was happening.
Yeah, well, it's just like a soap opera on TV, right? It's like you can come in to The Bold and the Beautiful at any episode and still piece together what's going on. You don't need to start at season one, episode one of The Bold and the Beautiful to figure out what's going on at season
three. Bold and the Beautiful, yeah, in season one, this so happened.
People are smart enough to figure this stuff out. So, yeah, I think in general, it's pretty good to give people that benefit of the doubt. But I tell you what, though, Em, it's like, you know, I'm sort of doing these videos that are 5 to 10 minutes long, but I see edits that are just as complex on your videos, Emp, and they're like 40 minutes long. And I actually don't quite understand how you're doing it. Because that would take me a year.
No, Emperor Lemon, he's got a weird, because I've seen him work, because he'll be editing a video at any time. I mean, there's just a bunch of people hanging out. It's like a party going on. Hmm. And he's just editing a video, and he'll make like a 5-minute clip in like an hour, and I have no idea how you have that type of focus. I have to be in a room isolated completely.
Well, I am half Asian, and also
I might do it.
Also, I edit on a laptop, and a lot of people when I say that they're like, really, like, what? Because most people are used to editing on like this big monitor, dual monitor setup, big editing window. But like, just for my entire YouTube existence, I've always edited on a laptop, and it's really helpful because I can just bring it around, put in my headphones, plug it in, and just start working basically at any time I want. And it's really helpful. And a lot of people, I had this conversation with Rusty when we first started talking about this, and he's like, how can you edit on a window that small? But I'd say it actually helps me out a lot, because
you have smaller eyes.
Yeah, exactly. And also,
Jesus Christ.
Most people these days watch videos on their phone. It's a screen like this big, like the size of the palm of your hand.
That's a good point.
So when you're scaling fonts and text and stuff, you have to be aware of that. And it's not like a small minority either. It's like, I think over 50% of the views I get on YouTube, at least, and I'm sure most of you do too, like if you go in the analytics, like 70, or on mobile 70%, device.
70% will be on handheld devices, yeah.
Wow.
And I know, I've always edited on a laptop, so I've always just been used to having my edits be legible within a small window. And I don't know, I think it's kind of helped me out for like sort of the mobile appeal. I don't know. We're getting into real editor central here.
Real technical stuff, yeah. Well, Emperor Lemon, you asked Twitter if they had questions for Internet Historian, or are we going to save those till the end?
We can start getting into some of those. There's a lot of interesting ones here. I think a big one that's actually very topical right now is, so Internet Historian, over a year ago, or may have been less than a year ago, you made a video about the doomed Fyre Festival.
Oh, yeah.
And recently, there's been a pretty high-profile documentary that came out about Fyre Festival.
Two of them.
It's on Netflix, and it's been very, very widely discussed, and a lot of people, like a lot of mainstream people, have really gotten into that.
Yeah, people have been recommending it. I'm not familiar with this festival at all, or whatever the controversy around it is.
So, Internet Historian, just based on the fact that your video preceded that, I was just wondering how you feel about this whole situation.
Yeah, I don't know. Fuck, I wish I'd done the prep work and actually have seen these two documentaries. Although I do intend to. I'm finding it difficult to get access to Hulu because I'm here in Australia. But I do have Netflix. I just haven't watched it yet. I'm really excited to see them, to be honest. I want to compare notes. What I've heard so far, though, which I'm very pleased about, is that not too much of the things that they touched on contradicts the things that I reported like a year earlier. So it's like, it's nice to know that I wasn't wrong about a whole lot of things.
Well, what is this festival? What's the controversy around it?
Oh, so Fyre Festival is a festival that somewhat happened. And it was organized by this guy, Billy McFarland, set in the Bahamas. And it was going to be the party to end all parties. And it ended up being a massive disaster on a very large scale.
Okay, shit.
Yeah, and the the original organizer, Billy McFarlane, ended up serving. He's in jail now. He's in for somewhere between 6 and 10 years for all sorts of things, wire fraud mostly. But then there's also civil lawsuits going on. So they'll start soon, I believe, because once you lose, you know, a criminal case, that's you then used as evidence, cited in the civil cases. So, yikes, it's not going to be good for him because a lot of these lawsuits it's down, are like $100 million.
Downward here. Spiral.
Yeah.
Well, when you say it was a disaster, I mean, like, what was there just a ton of crime, whatnot going on?
Well, it was
at this festival.
So it was supposed to go for 2 weeks. It was canceled at the end of the first day. You know, there was supposed to be 5,000 people there. In the end, only about 500 made it. The bands were canceled. The catering wasn't done. The accommodations weren't what were promised.
He should have got Jim Jones's marketing guy.
Wait, who's Jim Jones?
he's an American cult leader that convinced like a couple thousand people to move down to one of these islands,
Jonestown in Guyana.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and then they all drank Kool-Aid and killed themselves.
Yeah. Oh, yikes!
It was actually the second largest loss of American life before 9/11.
Oh,
wow! I didn't know that. Well, that's a little American history for you.
Holy shit! Yeah. Well, anyway, this Netflix documentary. I don't know. I think they look really interesting. I don't know. I'm pretty positive about it. It would have been nice to get a little shout out and mention, but to be honest, I think that opened themselves for all sorts of liability that they wouldn't want to. So I understand why they wouldn't do that as well. And you know, brings traffic into the channel and
Are you seeing traffic coming in from that, like a new comments, or is that just perceived traffic?
I mean, I suppose it's not that much more traffic, but you know, a little boost here and there, and it's been nice. There's like people tweeting nice things, and yeah, you know, it's
that's all it takes.
Yeah, that's right. So I've forgotten the question entirely, but overall, I feel pretty positive about it.
That's good. You mentioned earlier that you were a copywriter.
Yeah.
Is that a hellish job? That always seemed like an interesting job to me, because back in the day I used to watch like Mad Men or something, and I really thought it'd be cool to be in advertising, but then copywriting, I wasn't sure if that's something that'd be fun or not.
Most of the time it's not fun. It's pretty hard because my attention span isn't that good, and so you're supposed to be there like writing, you know, 8 hours a day in an office, and you can't write for 8 hours a day, you know. It's funny, response to my videos and stuff on YouTube has been like overwhelming, like positive, and I'm super grateful for that. But especially because I come from this industry where it's like, no matter what you write, nobody's happy with it on the first draft.
Right.
Like, you know, it's a sort of 50% rewrite minimum on everything. And usually, often the reaction from the client is like angry at first because they had this thing in their head of what it was going to be, and it ends up being completely different. And they have a little panic about it. And they go, oh, holy shit, this is going to be on my website. Oh, my God, this is going to be in the marketing campaign. And it's wrong. And, yeah, anyway. So you get a sort of lot of negative feedback.
You sort of worked within the media industry, because that's what a copywriter does. They work with advertisers and marketing people to make sure that their scripts are in order.
Yeah, well, mostly not script stuff. It's usually digital content I was working on. So, you know, stuff for websites, stuff for sometimes like email campaigns, newsletters, that sort of stuff. But yeah, in marketing and advertising, that's what I did my master's in. So just sort of went.
So how does it feel now, having gone to school for that, and then you find yourself in the end on YouTube? Like something that, I mean, did it help you at all, or is it just like completely separate?
Yeah, I don't know. It's I suppose it has been helpful in some ways. It feels like a massive waste of time in other ways. But, you know, these things compensate, because it's like if you're a little bit older, you can also feel a little bit more motivated to get things done. And you've also got a little bit of advantage as well in the way that you might make fewer mistakes, maybe. So
wait, what do you mean?
Well, I just mean if I had sort of started doing this stuff instead of going to university and going into like a normal career and then going to YouTube.
You're switching into YouTube rather than growing up on YouTube, where maybe you're not starting making videos with the idea that these have to be good and these have to be polished and
exactly.
Invoke emotion and whatnot.
Yeah, I think if I had started doing it when I was like 18 or something, it would have been Let's Plays for sure. I would have just
That's
gone with like cheap yeah, easy content and get
it's
it out.
It's funny because I'm kind of the opposite, where I was doing YouTube for years, and now I'm in school for sort of TV production, video production, where it's completely different. You have to like unlearn all of the stuff you know from YouTube that works on YouTube.
Yeah.
And it's just completely different priorities in what's acceptable and what's not.
Is that a bit strange? Like, do you ever find yourself, you must not correcting the lecturer, but it must feel very strange to have someone maybe who's even less experienced than you, Imp, sort of telling you how to do things?
No, I actually, there are like very valuable people at my school. One of my professors this year, I have him for two classes this year. He's actually teaching me in an After Effects class.
Oh, okay.
He worked on a documentary that got like nominated for an Emmy. So these are like legit people who know what they're doing. They're not just they didn't just like get a degree and start teaching. A lot of these professors are, I forget the word for the type of professor that's also in the actual field, but we have a lot of those types of professors where I go to school, and they're very knowledgeable. So I can't just disregard what they're saying, and I actually have to listen to a lot of them. But what I found is that YouTube is just a completely different frontier entirely from anything on TV. And it's just everything is different from the ground up. And I think in learning sort of how the other side works, I've developed sort of a better appreciation, and it's kind of easier for me to reconcile both television and YouTube now.
If you had the choice, which one would you go into?
Oh, definitely YouTube.
Yeah.
I get to be my own boss on YouTube, and that to me is just more valuable than anything else. Just having creative control, it's almost biggest benefit of
if you go into TV, then you're running a teleprompter or like operating a boom mic.
Yeah, TV
or just anything like that.
TV, you have to work your way up the ranks and do grunt work for many, many years before even getting a halfway respectable position. But on YouTube, I'm biased because I'm kind of already in a very good spot on YouTube. But I don't know. Might be different if I was just starting out and I didn't have all of this. But I don't know.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine even trying to work in like. Sorry, go ahead.
You wouldn't go into television either, Rusty?
Oh, no. It seems like it's just a huge downgrade. I mean, right, being your own boss, you can do whatever you want, and you can make money. You can make more money than you would if you were working in L.A. and, on the production set for like, a movie or a TV show. And that might seem really grandiose. You're going, wow, I made it. I'm on the production side of, I don't know, Inside Hollywood Studios or something like that. I don't know. But on YouTube, you just do it all yourself, and you get all the glory and cash or whatever.
You don't have to relinquish creative control. And
Yeah, much more fulfilling.
Yeah, it's also kind of nice that, like, I think one thing that would absolutely kill your soul is you know, if you make a bad video on YouTube, it's like, you know, you take your hits and that's it. And you sort of own up to it and you go, okay, well, this is my fault. But if you made a bad television show and it was a team effort, and you knew that, like, the lighting was bad, and it was
the network sunk millions of dollars into that project.
Yeah, and it's like, and also like some, like the lighting was fucked up, and you weren't in charge of the lighting, or maybe some asshole came in at the very end and fucked it all up in the edit, and you knew that it was a great product before the editor came along, and then you're just getting panned by critics. That would just eat away at you. You know.
It's got to be the worst feeling, right? You're a director, and you go in to watch your movie, and you go, it was the fucking editor. And it, because editing, you can really just completely change the mood of a movie. I mean, you have the director to try to make everything work out right, but it comes down to that editor's decision. And so it's like how much power they have is the scary thing. I don't know if I could ever get someone to edit my videos on YouTube. I'm not sure if that's something I'd be willing to ever give up, because you take all your content, and before you edit it, it's just boring garbage, or it can be. And then, you know, the editing process, you trim things out and you add emphasis here and there. So I always find that with a lot of YouTubers, they're very skeptical about giving up editing and passing it over to someone else, depending on the type of channel they have.
That's actually a pretty big thing. I think a lot of YouTubers are split on. Now, Internet Historian, I think you mentioned earlier, not in the show, but before to us, that you currently work with an editor on your videos. So I just wanted to ask how much of your videos are kind of done by you and how much are done by the editor. What's sort of the relationship there?
Yeah, it's funny. As you asked that, you just walked in. I'm not sure I should mention this now. Well, isn't it... do you want to mention that? Yeah, his name's Ryan. He's a really nice guy. It's been sort of more recent. Don't really do a whole lot of main channel stuff with. It's so weird talking about him because he's like 4 feet away from me now. I gotta talk about him like he's not here. The main channel stuff is really difficult to do with a second editor, I think, because it's like, there's too much like passing assets back and forth in between. And, you know, if you've seen the videos, it's like you might have 20 layers on something, and then that might mean 500 different assets. And then, you know, you might be working with 20 at any given moment. And it's like trying to sort out the version control on that alone is a massive task. So it's basically impossible. So there's some divisions of labor that work quite well. So I just finished the My Immortal Part 3. And So Ryan helped me on the music for that. And it's like he's working on like a separate computer, and he's got the rendered visual with the dialogue, and he's just like adding sound effects and stuff.
Okay.
And then he'll render out that, just the music and the sound effects, and then that'll come back to me. And then, you know, he can work on that for a couple of days. So that'll save me essentially a couple of days worth of work. So that's good. But otherwise, he's doing like the in the fields, most of the editing on that. And so he'll do sort of 60% to 75% to 80% on an in the field. And then I'll come in at the last 20% and do the polish. But I'm sort of always there going, okay, well, this is how this should present. Okay, this is what this should look like.
Right, you got to be looking over it a little bit.
Yeah, it wouldn't work if someone was remote, because it's like these are sort of in-the-moment decisions that are happening maybe every 10, 20 minutes.
So, yeah. Well, that's good. I would imagine it'd definitely be beneficial to have someone do the music, because I always add music and sound effects at the end, and... Mm. It's not really something that I don't think anyone else couldn't do. Like, you know, say, hey, maybe cut the audio out if at certain times to emphasize what I'm saying, or throw the sound effects in. And it always seems like a step that I never really want to take. It's like, it's necessary.
Yeah. Editing for me has always, I always think it's like a digital fingerprint, where especially on YouTube, where there's no actual restrictions on content. Like on television, everything is edited kind of more or less the same depending on whatever genre it is. Like every reality TV show in America that airs on American television is edited exactly the same, with the same pacing and the same musical cues and like sort of the same just shot selection. Format. But on YouTube, you're just given the keys to do whatever you want, and there are no editing rules. All those sort of gatekeeping rules have been lifted. So it's always something I look out for in YouTube videos, where a lot of YouTube viewers consider editing, they kind of understand it on a superficial level, where in order to impress a lot of people on YouTube, all you have to do is throw in some whooshy cool After Effects transitions and people will be like, hey, that's good editing. But I just started off making YouTube poops for like 5 years, which is kind of nothing but editing, where the only contribution you make to the content is through your editing. And I look, when I'm watching a YouTuber, I look at editing more for content and stylization. And I think a lot of problems that some YouTubers fall into is they get an editor, and it's not like you, Internet Historian, where they're in the same room and you can just immediately give notes and commands. They just kind of outsource this work to just some guy.
Oh, yeah. No, that's the worst.
Like in a completely different continent. And what ends up happening, and I can sort of tell when these people do it, is it just kind of looks generic.
Yeah.
Because when you just don't have the same person writing and recording and editing it, it's hard to stay on the same page and add your own little sense of personal flair. If I could give an example, The Right Opinion does this, where he has like 5 or 6 editors on one video at times. And yeah, he outsources his videos to like 6 editors. I don't know the exact process with it, but I always see it when he posts a new video, he credits the editors, and usually there's like at least 3 of them. And I don't know. It bothers me. A lot of people are fine with it and they don't even notice it. And as long as you have like smooth looking motion graphics and keyframing, then they don't really care. But for me, it's just like when you relinquish control of editing, that's like half of the information that's telegraphed to the audience, and you're taking it out of your hands. And I could just never do that. I always do just all of my own stuff 100%. Maybe 99.9%, but still, it's just my mentality and approach to editing is very different from a lot of people. But I certainly feel like people who edit their own videos on YouTube, they certainly are more memorable.
Yeah,
it kind of sticks with you, where the eccentricities and the kind of unique stuff that you would add to your own version of it, it's not replicable by anyone else, and it makes you stand out, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. Yeah, things end up having their own sort of signature. But also, I'd also say it has been, like, super useful in some of the decision-making process, though, like, in ways you wouldn't think of. So, you know, a lot of the time when you're editing, it's like you sort of have to make these decisions about things, and then sometimes it's also like, I know something isn't working and I don't know why, and then you can just get immediate feedback, and that's fantastic. And that's sometimes a bit harder to do on your own, because then you have to sort of puzzle, you know, you have to sort of problem solve to figure out what's wrong.
You don't know if anything's funny because you're doing it yourself. So it's like, you know, all your jokes are in your head. You're not laughing at yourself. Or maybe you are. I don't know. But, I mean, right. Yeah, because it makes sense to you, but it's not going to make sense to the audience necessarily until you present it to someone. Do you have any fears with YouTube going forward?
It's going to be very interesting to see what happens with this Article 13. I'm glad you pivoted, by the way. I feel like we're getting a little bit too inside baseball, you know?
But
they could just look it up.
I do worry about a lot of the censorship stuff. Especially, you know, a lot of the mob-led censorship. And I do worry about some of the Article 13 things, but I don't know. What are you guys' fears?
Well, I guess, like, or I mean, luckily, or maybe I'm just ignorant, but Article 13 isn't going to affect us in the States as much, or no. It could be a very ignorant thing that I'm saying. But I mean, with like a lot of the terms of service changes to YouTube and right, we were talking about like a mob pressure to have things changed and guidelines moved and the goalposts moved. It's like YouTube's just folding to all of these things, and they can't revert back. They can't reverse their decisions. So they're just slowly dwindling down the appeal of their site and why someone might go there in the first place, and they're molding it into something that might be unusable very soon.
Yeah, sort of inching forward to be more and more like television. I don't know. I was hoping we'd get onto a topic like this, because you know, one thing I have noticed with the podcast is you know, it tends to be like three or four of us sort of bashing YouTube. But
yeah,
it's not like they get a shot at the fence, you know. And so I sort of thought, oh, it would be nice.
Well, they never talk about anything. They never mention.
Well, what are they going to do? Come on the podcast?
Okay, we'd be happy. Anyone listening to this who possibly works at YouTube, we'd be happy to have you on the show and just explain anything about YouTube. We'd be eternally grateful.
Well, look, let me stand in there. I'm gonna alienate myself from the audience and let me stand in their place, because I think I can make some fairly good arguments against some of this stuff.
All right.
Well, so one thing that I've wondered. Okay. All right. Do you have anything particular right now?
No. Sorry. Continue on with what you were saying.
So they made YouTube Kids, and now, and also they had age restrictions on videos where you had to be an adult to watch the video.
And they also
you can get around.
They also have a restricted mode for like schools or just any household that wants to limit the content to just non-mature content.
So I wonder why they're taking such a huge stance and changing, cracking down with these newer guidelines under the guise of it, you know, protecting children from seeing violent things or smoking or alcohol.
Well, I actually
whatever.
Think it's more about that. It sort of leans now into the idea of political correctness, and it's not just about
too, sure.
shielding your little Timmy's eyes, but it's about what some guy with who's in charge of an interest group is going to rile up the troops and write a hit piece about YouTube and damage their reputation. I think that's a lot of the reason they've been sort of doing the guidelines changes recently.
Well, can I make an example with the kid thing? With the Knife Game song, particularly. So these are now against the Knife Game song videos that I make, playing Five Finger Flay and singing a song. They're now against YouTube's terms of service. And I don't know why. I don't know why. Why can't those exist? Why wouldn't they be able to exist on YouTube with an age restriction?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I suppose they're worried about being liable for other people participating in this sort of stuff. You know, it's funny, when I was researching the video for the kids self-immolating, they were being sued. They were in the middle of the lawsuit for this girl who had played the fire challenge, and the grounds of the lawsuit was that YouTube had all these videos up of people setting themselves on fire, and there was another one which is even worse. It was the boiling water challenge. Christ. By the way, there's no way to do the boiling water challenge without getting horribly burnt. Because at the moment,
what does this consist of?
It's literally pour some boiling water on a friend.
Oh my god!
Yeah, on a friend. Okay.
Yeah.
So
it's like.
Do people actually know how hot
boiling water
is?
Yeah. You'll immediately get second or third degree burns from contact with boiling
skin's
water.
Skin's going to start melting off. You're going to look like Freddy Krueger.
It'll just come off, yeah, for sure. People don't realize anything over about 65 degrees Celsius is going to cause second, third degree burns really quickly.
But this, all right, so this whole thing of like you have to, they have to protect the protect themselves from potential lawsuits of people trying to recreate what they see in the videos. But there are so many. That's an impossible thing. If you try to regulate that across the board, then you have things like videos where people are doing driving stunts, where they're stunt drivers, or skydiving is dangerous. Maybe bungee jumping from a bridge. People, there's so many things that people can try, that they might try, but to eliminate everything potentially dangerous or harmful from their platform in order to protect themselves or people from attempting it.
Yeah.
You're just, that's a ton of stuff. I mean, people want to see a fire breather, you know, that's cool.
Yeah.
Someone juggling knives or something like.
Well, I think there's a couple of things there. So it's like, the first is, you know, by not removing the videos being seen to occur, I don't buy into this argument, by the way, but this is what they would say. It would be something like, by not removing the videos, we might be seen as encouraging. And a lot of these stunts have a very low barrier to entry. So a stuntman working on a stunt car is obviously going to be someone licensed, and there's going to be all sorts of insurance involved. And, you know, someone has to have a driver's license and a car in the first place. If it's the fire challenge, then or the knife game, then all you need is a knife or an accelerant and a match. The other thing is that there's sort of two sides to the lawsuit. One's the financial side, and the other is the PR side. So what tends to come with a lawsuit is a whole lot of bad publicity. And, you know,
I mean, they're folding to this bad publicity all the time.
Yes.
Couldn't they just do what most of these companies should do and ignore it? Because if they cater to it, it usually never brings their company
to a better place. It forces them to appeal to more benign and more benign demands.
Yeah, I mean, it constantly dumbs down the content for sure. But I'm not sure they can just ignore it, because it doesn't take many from a special interest group to lobby against advertisers and have some sway.
Right.
And from their perspective, it's like, okay, we're spending billions of dollars on a platform that arguably may not even yet be profitable after a decade.
After they have all the corporate brands tied in and everything,
yeah,
there's still no actual evidence that YouTube is profitable as a platform.
And the other side of that is that it's such a precarious position between absolute disaster and absolute fortune, because if they play everything right, they could. There's so much to gain.
Right, the cultural influence, having power over what is basically the next generation of television, and having it just centralized under one company, that's priceless.
Yeah, the long-term financial
worth incentives. Any like potential profit.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, the cultural influence, absolutely, and also the long-term prospective financial gain. Which could be, you know, immense, and it could basically solidify them as a monopoly for the next couple of decades.
They already kind of are in that regard, even though they might not be profitable. In terms of a place where just regular internet users can upload content, make revenue, the only other thing like it is Twitch, and that's really only live streaming. So if you want to do anything else, like make any long-form video where you sit down and edit it and record audio, and anything more of artistic value than just live streaming, YouTube is basically your only option if you actually want to have a viable career where you can earn revenue.
Yeah, that's right.
Right, because even if it's not profitable, it's Google-owned. So Google owns the only thing that you can do this on. And so that is worth a lot as well. There's no competition there. And that's almost like it might be worth it not being profitable or to lose money into it because you own that entire side of the market.
I think that's the calculation they're playing. Yeah. And so every time there's a threat, they actually need to treat it like it's a proper threat. And, you know, the other side is, I suppose, just keep in mind, a lot of these arguments I'm just making for the sake of defense of YouTube. I don't necessarily
buy it. Right.
But one thing I would say is that, you know, So I make money from YouTube, but I consider my relationship with them is that I'm a subcontractor.
Right.
Okay.
And that's something I really agree with, because a lot of people, and there's a video I want to make about this one day, an unscripted commentary, but I'll get into some of it now, where a lot of people are just incredibly confused on what exactly a YouTuber's role is in content creation, where you got skeptical people saying, oh, YouTube's not a real job. If you're complaining about YouTube, just get a real job. And then there's people on the other end saying, like, YouTube is just like, YouTube is like our boss, and they have to be accountable for all the wrongdoings. But realistically, the relationship is that YouTube has like no direct employment relationship with YouTubers. Right. YouTubers are basically independent contractors. All of them are just independent contractors, and they're choosing to spend time and effort curating content for this platform. And in exchange, they get ads on their videos and therefore revenue.
Yeah, that's right. And so basically any good treatment they give you, I mean, it's not a good thing, but you know, any good treatment they might give you is really just what you would call goodwill on their part. And if they just want to have you off the platform, that's really their prerogative, at least legally speaking. And so anytime someone, you know, sort of kicks up trouble, it sort of feels like YouTube's This would be their argument, okay? Not mine. Look, we've got 2,000 employees here working at YouTube. We pay them 200 grand plus on average. They are some of the most talented people around the world. They're some of the most vetted people around the world. We really don't want to lose these people. They've got mortgages and families and futures and prospects. And we're not going to sacrifice that for one or two edgy content creators. You know, we've got a lot on the line here. An advertiser might be worth, you know, AT&T, for example, who pulled out, they are worth $500 million to us. That's a lot of jobs, and we're not willing to risk that for the sake of keeping the Fire Challenge on, or what have you. I mean, so yeah, I mean, I suppose that would be the argument that they would make. But
yeah,
you know,
I mean, and that's not even a bad argument necessarily. It just seems like the implications of it, you know, they're not, doesn't seem like they're fairly regulating videos across the board in the first place. And say something like, for instance, the Knife Game song, why I can't have it on my channel, but it's, you know, heavily, or it's like people were saying it was prominent in Wayne episode 2 on their premium platform. So the argument that they're trying to protect someone from it, or to stop people from recreating it, they're still showing this stuff. It's just only whenever it's on their terms are they allowed certain things to be seen or uploaded on their platform.
I think with a lot of this stuff, YouTube has been a little too chicken with kind of bending to these corporate forces, where if you think long term, not even that long term, like maybe 10 or 20 years from now, television subscriptions continue to decline. Newspaper industry is all but dead at this point in terms of actual print. It's all moved online. And a lot of those, even those publications, are going bankrupt now, where I forget which one got recently sold for $5 million, but it lost like 90% of its value after like 3 years. And even these online publications are struggling. And recently, actually, YouTube cut a deal in July with Legacy Media to curate their stuff on YouTube promote it more. But I always think, I just look at how society's changing, and I just feel like YouTube has so much leverage that they're not using right now. Like, yeah, maybe this advertiser will pull out, but what are you going to do? Advertise on television, which is losing millions of subscribers every single year, and pull out of YouTube.
That's a good point.
Which is
YouTube,
like,
is the power here.
Exactly. Like, out of anyone like under age 15, they're not watching TV. They're on YouTube, and that's not going to change anytime soon. YouTube's just going to keep growing, and even as like some social media platforms like Facebook is declining, YouTube's still growing. There's just the idea of watching user-generated content on demand for free is too valuable. Yeah. And everyone is shifting to YouTube, and I feel like they have so much leverage that they're just not using.
They're just bending
to whatever like mini publication threatens to write a hit piece about some YouTuber.
They do and they don't. You know, they may still not be profitable yet at this point. They may still be operating at a loss. You know, it's hard to know without seeing some of the things behind the scenes, and you know.
I think these things, YouTube is losing. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying, you know, I think these things are a little more complicated, and that also, you know, okay. So I'm in an office at the moment, but if I went next door and started asking people about their watching habits on stuff, I mean, we're in a little bit of a bubble where everything is YouTube, and you know, I've got like a Netflix subscription and I've got a television. I don't really use them, but. You know, if I asked everyone else, they would probably spend most of their time on YouTube just for like bits and pieces. They wouldn't really take it as the main form of their content consumption. And
it's probably Netflix.
At least not with the sort of maybe 25 and up sort of group. They're still watching stuff on television, man.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. The whole boomer generation, like Rusty, they love their TV. I sure know my parents literally only watch TV and never go on YouTube.
Mm.
But just in my age group, and I think starting with kids about 3 to 5 years younger than me, TV is basically non-existent for them. I think some of them move on to just adopt their parents' habits and start watching TV, but it's really just... YouTube's influence on younger people cannot be understated. And as each year goes on, there's going to be less people watching television and more people watching YouTube. So I guess
this whole thing of if YouTube cannot be profitable and perhaps it doesn't have the amount of power that we perceive it to have, can this type of platform even exist? I mean, with vid.me, you know, they tried to start up a competing site and they just couldn't afford to do it. YouTube can afford to do it, but if having a platform where people can upload whatever videos they want and it's easy for everyone else to watch, if that just doesn't work, then like is that whole platform idea just going to fail in the future, or is it going to have to just transition into something entirely different?
Well, here's my idea with why YouTube, despite never actually being shown to be monetarily profitable, here's why they're still in business and why I don't think they're going away anytime soon. While monetarily speaking, they may not be making as much, the value of YouTube that they get from one, cultural influence, and two, advanced audience analytics and data mining, I think in terms of Google, that makes it worth any loss that they might run on YouTube.
Yeah, that's right. It's a long-term strategy.
Right.
But I think in some ways also, it's funny, by being the pioneers, they can also be setting themselves up for more competition because, okay, so. You've got this video platform, and you have to allow for millions upon millions of people to upload millions upon millions of videos, and the data storage alone is probably just an astronomical cost, and it's like that is also a massive barrier to entry to your competitors because to any competitor. Yeah. So it's like you have to, but at the same time, you need to reduce your operating costs. So you need to create a sort of economies of scale and develop new technologies. So Google is there making new forms of data storage at lower cost. But in doing that, they're also inventing cheaper data storage over time. So all of a sudden, you might find that your competitors might also be able to purchase data quite cheaply. Yeah, and you may also find that there's a certain threshold that you only have to meet before you can start being a serious competitor. So, for example, on YouTube, you might find that 98% of videos are trash, and that it's the 2% of videos that are actually attracting viewers. Well, then that may mean you only need 2% of YouTube's storage. That may translate to something like 5% of the operating cost. Well, okay.
Well, you also have to think
a business could
too,
come
like
in
a...
and be a serious competitor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the idea of a YouTube competitor gets thrown around whenever there's basically a big YouTube controversy. But my opinion on the issue is that I just don't really see it happening. At least not for the next 10 years or so.
I think that's a little wishful thinking. I think in 10 years, you will not recognize what we're doing on YouTube. Through small changes, we're going to be doing something completely different in a different media.
Yeah, I think it'll be very different in 10 years.
10 years ago, when you looked at YouTube, and when you look at it now, it is almost unrecognizable with the amount of changes they'd made. But the reason I think YouTube has just become ingrained in our society, and it's going to be very, very hard to chop down that proverbial tree, is YouTube, behind the scenes for the last 10 years or so, they've been making tons of deals with all these big old media companies. You had the entire music industry, the entire American music industry, and Vivo basically syndicate their music videos through YouTube. You have all these TV personalities starting to gradually become integrated with YouTube. That's and true. A lot of TV shows uploading clips to YouTube. And it's clear kind of from the decision-making of the site over the last 3 years at least that they are moving towards at least a convergence between television and independent creators on the same platform. And they're leaning towards much more support for television-type content.
Yeah.
So the only real way I see a legit YouTube competitor competing with the site, one, it would have to be like some billionaire funding it, like Elon Musk or something, because just the operating cost of competing with a site of this scale is ridiculous. And two, it would have to emphasize independent creators over corporations. And if that were to come, and I think there's a fairly decent chance that it might, at least within the next 10 years.
That'll be difficult because Google owns they're the ones that are supplying the ads to YouTube. So,
exactly.
I mean,
they have their whole revenue system figured out, and whatever the competitor will have to have a completely different system that's either as good or better than YouTube's. But
yeah, that's true.
Getting back to what I was saying, this new competitor, this legitimate competitor, would have to emphasize independent creators like how YouTube was back in the day, because it's clear YouTube is moving far away from that, and that's going to be the opening for the would-be YouTube competitor. But it just seems like such a daunting task for any entrepreneur or venture capitalist that might want to fund a project on that scale. And it would require kind of the online community to make a choice where, do we want a future where kind of the entertainment industry is curated by just regular Joe Schmoes that just come from the normal population? Or do we want it more where eventually everyone gets kind of corporatized and it all sort of converges into TV Lite, basically?
Yeah, it's kind of going in the same cycle as television.
I suppose to inject a little bit of optimism into it, you know, I would say that the main competitor for YouTube is not supposed alternatives to YouTube. It's just the rest of the internet, because what they're really interested in is watch time, and so the main competitors to YouTube are like Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, obviously
TikTok.
Twitch, obviously right. Twitch and Netflix.
Yeah, TikTok.
TikTok, oh, yeah. These things,
better watch out.
These things that
TikTok
all,
is coming.
But you can tell by the way they measure their metrics. It's all about watch time. Right. And so I think they are in their best interests to make sure that their content is always fulfilling for the watcher. And if they do start dumbing things down too much, you know, the watch time will be reflected by that. So, you know, there are some of the right incentives in place. I'll also say this, because you mentioned venture capitalists, and this is one way I think that YouTube might change in the future, and this is just total speculation. But I would say that you're going to start seeing venture capitalists investing in some of these more creative platforms. So you can see them saying, all right, to someone who's maybe a minor celebrity, make a podcast. Here's $2 million. Go for it. Okay, Jack Black, don't bother about making a movie. Here's a contract for $5 million. Go and make a YouTube channel, and here's a team. And, you know, so on and so on. And I think with that, you're also going to get some larger players who are going to come in and demand a fairer dispensing of the rules.
Right, exactly. Okay, so as we're moving into maybe a more corporate, mainstream entertainment type of system, then the people who ran that one before, they can make the changes. If they want their person, if they want like their guy who they're investing in to make YouTube videos, they'll say, hey, we need this person to be allowed to do whatever. Yes. On your website.
Yeah, you're gonna have sort of maybe some of the smaller, maybe the medium sized players coming in, protecting their investments, and starting to invest in some of these YouTube platforms, and I think with that, YouTube is also going to see more growth, and then they're also going to see more stability, and maybe in the long term, then you may also see them less risk averse with advertisers. Maybe.
Well, you kind of already start to see a situation where YouTube kind of has a different levels of creators with different treatment on sort of what rules apply to them and what don't. Hmm. Where basically the big budget Hollywood mainstream music industry, for example, they can just get away with so much stuff in music videos, and it's never a problem.
Yeah,
at all.
Sure, and if it's under the guise of art or whatever. I mean, with the Triple X Tentacion, who, you know, died, he made the video's big controversy where he was lynching a child. And the video's, I believe it's still up, but, you know, they're making a statement. It can be argued that that's art. And,
yeah, which, but I mean, still, I think that it is. If a regular Joe Schmo YouTuber tries that, they'll just get taken down and booted off the platform. But if Childish Gambino just shoots a guy in the head, then...
Right.
There's no way that video's getting taken down because it's a big AAA industry artist.
Maybe. I think YouTube is such a massive platform, it's very hard to be consistent about these things. And, you know, they are susceptible to pressure. But I would also say that I'm very surprised at how much, you know, things that are very lightly veneered with the guise of art are allowed on YouTube that aren't related to big corporations. So, for example, go to YouTube and type in nude yoga. And it's like, there's an enormous amount of content there that's just like
Jesus,
very, very explicit. And they let it stay up there. They know about it.
But I just don't understand that, because that's where the regulations or the rules are applied differently from person to person. I mean, I don't always want to just keep talking about my own shit, but that's just where I see a lot of these inconsistencies or what brought up these questions. Where I make a song called The New Song, and it's kind of like this tongue-in-cheek thing about suicide, and that's definitely not allowed after review, and you know, Trusted Flagger was fighting with these people to get the strike repealed. But then you have, like, Bo Burnham or something, and I think I brought this up on a past podcast, who has a song explaining how you can kill yourself and that you definitely should do it. And I think it's called Kill Yourself, and it's 33 million views. I would argue that, yes, he should be able to have that song up.
Yeah.
But I don't understand why does it apply differently?
Well, it's like people. I said, where Bo Burnham has ascended above the ranks of just regular YouTuber Joe, and now he has industry backing, and he's part of these industries. And if he gets his videos taken down, they're not just fucking over Bo Burnham. They're fucking over whatever record company is producing his music or whatever.
Well, that goes back to what you were saying.
Backing his film.
Internet historian, you were saying like these investors might be able to have the rules changed, but if this is the case that it's already happening, they're only protecting their own assets and not everyone's.
Yeah, it depends. I mean, you know, if it's a lawsuit, it might be more generally applying, though.
Right.
But I suppose, again, this might be an argument that YouTube would make. This isn't necessarily what I believe, but, you know, just to give them a little bit of devil's advocate, you would say something like, what we're endeavoring to do is create a platform that's completely open and on a scale that's never been attempted before. When people come into Hollywood, when people come into the record industry, they are actually comparatively very well vetted, and there are processes in place to boot certain people out. Doesn't work all the time. That's where you Harvey Weinstein's and all that sort of stuff. But with YouTube, you could have anyone on there. You can have murderers and rapists making YouTube channels. You can have anyone on YouTube. So we cannot afford to give people the benefit of the doubt off the bat unless they have some sort of corporate reputational backing. That might be an argument that they would make.
Okay,
so I gotta get sponsored by Fritos or something.
Yeah, well, I would say a couple things about that. Yeah, actually, I think that probably would help you if you could get something sponsored. And also, I suspect that that is starting to be integrated into the algorithm as well. I think, just judging by the way my videos are monetized, I think all of the videos that have had an ad integration in them have all been monetized, and some of them have been edgier videos because I've thought, oh, well, it's supported by a sponsor, therefore I can be a little edgier, and then they all get monetized, and I think it's because the algorithm's picking up that it has a sponsor, therefore it is more advertiser friendly, and therefore it should be monetized as well.
I have a video. I have one of the Knife Game song videos that was a sponsored video. I was paid to make it, and I was wondering, I was like, man, does this even go against contract? Because I'm making the choice to take this video down. But I wonder if I just, I don't know, make it public again and see if I can sneak it past them.
All right, I think we should take a break here. And
sure,
then...
we have you for a while.
But we should do a second part, like immediately after this, where we answer some of those Twitter questions.
Yeah, sure.
And maybe get into some other discussion. All right, so I guess for all of our great listeners out there, we will be back next time. Stay tuned.